Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the United Nations has endorsed the Trump Board of Peace to implement a post-conflict peace plan and transitional government for Gaza. What might we expect from this board? And first, when Trump laid out the creation of the board at Davos, it went far beyond this mandate. What is he proposing, and who is signing up for it? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In support of the U.S. proposed peace plan for Gaza, President Trump proposed something he called a Board of Peace. It seemed as though the proposal was for it to serve as a transitional government authority to replace the Israeli military and to enable its withdrawal from the territory. And with this in mind, the UN Security Council empowered it to act on the organization's behalf, presumably as a neutral body to ensure things like the delivery of humanitarian assistance, physically rebuilding a region that's been devastated from war, and overseeing security on issues like the return of refugees who've been fleeing the conflict. But it was introduced by the American president at the World Economic Forum meetings in Davos this January. And that introduction has led it to become a bit of a controversial body. Trump has advanced a vision of the body that possibly could challenge the UN, a plan for countries to pay, I suppose, the organization, maybe the US, maybe the president himself, in what has been described as a pay-to-play model for the organization. And so on today's show, we're going to start with an exploration of what is the Board of Peace. Our panel is Stefan Wolf. He's professor of international security at the University of Birmingham in the UK. His latest book, Ethnic Conflict: Critical Concepts in Political Science, and he's recently written an article in The Conversation entitled Donald Trump's Board of Peace Looks Like a Privatized UN with One Shareholder, the US President. And Francesco Grillo, he is professor at Bocconi University and visiting fellow at the European University Institute. He's joining us from the UK as well. You can find his articles at The Conversation, two recent ones. One, Europe must reject Trump's nonsense accusations of civilization erasure, but it urgently needs a strategy of its own. And quite relevant to today's conversation, Donald Trump's Board of Peace signed at Davos, key points I took away from my visit to the ski resort. Thank you both so very much for joining us, and see if we can get our head around a handle on what exactly is this Board of Peace. So, Stefan Wolf, I'll start with you. What is the Board of Peace? What was sort of the original vision of it? And has it really described in the intro that it seems to have strayed from that vision? Is that a fair description?
Yes, I think it's a very fair description, in particular because what the Board of Peace was last week in Davos and what it is today and what it might be next week could be very well three completely different things, given how volatile Donald Trump's decision-making is. What we know so far is that the charter that the Board of Peace has given itself, or that Trump and his advisors have given the Board of Peace, is actually quite a bit away from the original mandate that we had in a UN Security Council resolution that endorsed Trump's peace plan or ceasefire plan for Gaza. So what was envisaged there was that you would have this Board of Peace that would be chaired by Trump and that would basically oversee governance in Gaza during a transitional phase away from the current state of war, Israeli occupation, towards some form of future self-governance. However, that might work itself out in the broader Middle East peace process. So that was what was agreed unanimously without any vetoes in the UN Security Council. So actually quite positive and one of those rare occasions where we actually did have a degree of functioning multilateralism. Now, the deep irony of that is that basically Trump took that as a springboard, if you want, and created something that in many ways now looks like a privatized United Nations that has given itself, based on nobody knows exactly what authority, vast competences to basically, some people would say, meddle elsewhere in the world. Others perhaps would put a slightly more positive or optimistic view on it and say, contribute to conflict resolution elsewhere in the world. But it is entirely unclear on what legal basis it exists, what authority or competences it will have, and crucially, from my perspective, what it will actually do to the United Nations, which Trump has always been very critical of, despite the occasional sort of nod in the UN's direction. And very briefly, or very shortly before he actually announced his Board of Peace, he also announced the withdrawal of the United States from something like 30 or so different bodies and sub-organizations of the United Nations, which isn't just that the U.S. sort of pulls out of that. Crucially, it also means that it pulls out the often quite considerable U.S. funding. So you have, on the one hand, defunding the United Nations, potentially undermining the United Nations, and then you have this creation of this odd entity that looks, as I said, to me more like a privatized version of the UN. So put two and two together, it doesn't make five, but it looks like something that is potentially a rival to the UN in a broader sense.
We're going to delve more into detail with that. But Francesco Grillo, I love your thoughts on this as well. I mean, you were there at Davos and saw the veiling of this. In your estimation, what is this board and what is it seeking to accomplish?
I would say that I would be even more radical than Stephen. This board of peace doesn't have very much to do with Resolution 2083 of the UN Security Council. It doesn't even mention the word Gaza. It's very true. The legal basis of the board of peace is a sort of unknown quantity. Just to be clear, the Board of Peace is not even a private multinational like the ones that were represented at Davos by their CEOs, because normally a CEO has got constraints in his own power, legal constraints, controls from the SEC in the United States or whatever it is in elsewhere, and more importantly, he cannot expel shareholders at his will. No, it's impossible. The power of Donald Trump into this board of peace would be even more absolute than the power that, as I say in my article, that a Roman emperor would have in at the time of the Roman Empire. And by the way, in a sense, he would be even more powerful than Putin or Xi Jinping, you know? So it is a very odd creature. It does not have very much to do with the resolution of the Security Council. However, if I can add one thing to the analysis, I should also say that the preamble, the introduction of the Board of Peace is somewhat even right. When the Board of Peace says that we should depart from an approach to govern the world which does not work any longer, I think it is true. It is true. It is true that the old world order is not functioning any longer, and that we need to find a different way, not to govern complexity, you know, as to say. So this is very true. And in fact, if you want, even the resolution of 2083 of the UN Security Council is a demonstration that the world order is not working any longer. That resolution was so vague in terms of what to be done with Gaza that the President of the United States and his advisor could somewhat link to that resolution, this board of peace. No? So again, we need a new world order in a very big way. But quite honestly, I consider the board of peace more like a new provocation, probably even a clever provocation from the President of the United States, not a serious rival to the United Nations, and even less an attempt to create a new world order.
No, I think it's a good point that all of us who've followed the UN know that the UN itself has engaged in quite a bit of analysis of reform, particularly on things like peacekeeping. The Brahimi report and the so-called HIPPO report have all been ways that the UN's tried to examine the ways in which it's fallen short. I think anybody following the UN would understand that criticism. But I guess the question, I mean, is this board any sort of a viable replacement? So Stefan Wolf, in my intro, I called this a pay-to-play kind of scheme. Countries have to pay, what, $1 billion to become a permanent member, but any country could become a permanent member. What does this say about the board itself? And kind of the bigger question, who are they paying? You know, who's receiving this money and how is it going to be used?
Well, this is all still very much up in the air. I mean, there are some indications in the charter that the board has given itself. I mean, what's interesting is those that are invited by Donald Trump, they can join for free for 3 years. But if they want to become permanent members and actually want to cough up $1 billion, they have to pay that within the first 12 months. So that already sort of gives you an odd feeling, let's put it like that. It's like you have to really commit very early on and you probably forfeit your $1 billion if you then decide that actually after 3 years it doesn't quite look like what you were promised. So I think that's one thing that's quite odd. It is entirely unclear who you would actually pay that money and where that money would be held. So it's not anything like the whatever the UN trust fund or anything like that. I mean, that maybe they'll set something like that up, but at the moment it's not clear. Where we do have some clarity is that the money that the Board of Peace will have, probably mostly funded from those membership fees, if you want, that will be spent on projects decided at the discretion of the board and with a very sort of hefty dose of influence by the chairman, who also apparently will have some degree of sort of single player veto power in that. Beyond that, we have really no idea of how the president intends to spend that money. Will that be spent on peacekeeping, on economic reconstruction, on facilitating negotiations, on training mediators? There's no information there. So there's a lot of speculation, of course. Well, how surprised would we all be if a large amount of this money goes to property development, for example, to create the Riviera or the Gaza Riviera, the Riviera of the Middle East. And it just so happens that the most competitive and compelling bids come from people relatively close to the president or involved in the Board of Peace. We don't know. It just does not fill me with great confidence that this money will be spent in any way more effectively than money that is now clearly missing in United Nations budgets. And if I may add one other thing here, I absolutely agree with what you both said about the shortcomings of the United Nations. But we also shouldn't be too critical of the United Nations as an organization for two reasons. One is that the one thing that for which we have absolutely solid evidence is that peacekeeping actually works. I mean, you can crunch the numbers in any conceivable way. I've just finished a book with some colleagues where we even used machine learning to investigate those claims. You can do any number of case studies, and you will find that more likely than not, a UN peacekeeping operation will actually bring peace, keep peace, sustain peace. And the other thing is that, I mean, we can all complain about the United Nations, but the United Nations is only as good and as powerful and as well-resourced and as decisive as its member states are. And I mean, the P5, including United States, Russia, China, France, and Britain, they do not necessarily have the most stellar track record in enabling the United Nations to do really what is required. So yes, it's not perfect. We would all be better off with something that was more effective. But by the same token, it's really hard to see how the Board of Peace will fit that particular bill.
I think that's a great point. And you listen to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today's topic, President Trump's proposal for a so-called Board of Peace. What is it? What is it seeking to accomplish? And what are its challenges, in particular to the United Nations? Our guests are Stefan Wolf, he's from the University of Birmingham, and Francesco Grillo of Bocconi University. And Francesco, Stefan just sort of highlighted the organization's only as good, only as committed as the member states themselves and their commitment to this. Also, by the way, the member states have to have capabilities to carry out these missions. Who exactly are on the Board of Peace right now? And because a number of the news reports are suggesting that, I mean, one of the real key challenges is the US and a whole lot of countries that aren't necessarily who you might describe as the most powerful, most competent countries in the world to be able to carry out some of these peacekeeping missions.
Yes, Doug, if I have to do a forecast about what is going to happen with the Board of Peace, is that it will not go that far, quite honest. The states that accepted the invitation are basically sort of 20 something. From South America, there is Argentina, of course, and Milei and Paraguay. From Southeast Asia, there is quite surprisingly, I must say, Indonesia and then Vietnam. From Europe, no surprise, we have Hungary and Kosovo. Then we have, I think, if I'm not wrong, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, few other countries which are not exactly like the sort of liberal democracy, no? And the number of the states that accepted the membership is stayed the same since 10 days ago when they signed the agreement. So there has not been other entries, which tells me that the Board of Peace as a possible privatization of the United Nations will not go that far. And probably this was not the initial intention of the President of the
Francesco,
United States.
can I follow up, on one of the members? Italy, Giorgia Meloni gave a kind of interesting response, to that invitation. That, if I understand this, that Italy's actually constitutionally forbidden, prohibited from joining the organization. Is
Oh,
that?
I think that all European countries are forbidden by their own constitution to enter a club, if you want to call it that way, where the chairman is nominated for life and has got the veto on decision and can expel member states at his will. I would say that probably is unconstitutional even for the American Constitution. So that's no surprise at all. But if I can just finish on what will happen with the Board of Peace, to me is probably the only thing which is really worth to consider. That is that Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the Emirates, Egypt, and of course, Israel also join this strange creature. And I think that at the end of the day, the Board of Peace will sort of downsize its mission and will go with a different decision-making structure back to its initial purpose, which is about sort of governing the transitional phase in Gaza. This is also quite vague and not very clear, but I think this is the most that we can expect from the Board of Peace, quite honestly.
And Stefan, Francesco kind of raises this question about whether is there any sort of staying power with respect to the Board of Peace. I know generally with respect to organizations, they can get proposed, but whether or not they have that staying power is at least in part, are they able to carry out the policies, the missions that they're asked to carry out? So I would imagine whether or not the Board of Peace has any sort of staying power is at least partially going to be how well they take on the mission of that they were created, to take that on. So do you think 5 years from now we're going to be talking at all about this Board of Peace, or is this something that's just kind of created on a whim, this attempt to try to gather some money, I suppose, or something or another, and it'll probably just kind of go away?
Well, I think it might fall at the first hurdle if the peace process in Gaza doesn't progress. I mean, it's not looking desperate yet, but it's also not looking as good as one might have hoped after the peace plan was announced last autumn. So I think it might not even be able to fulfill the original mission for which it was authorized by the United Nations. I think the next problem that we are having is that another reading of it is to basically create a huge PR effort behind Donald Trump's next campaign for the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, if that goes as I think most people expect, and somebody else is found more worthy than the 47th president of the United States, he might lose interest in the Board of Peace anyway, because it clearly is not working for him. But also, he might just become distracted by other things. So, I mean, there was a lot in the news about Greenland. Now, I mean, it's gone all quiet about Greenland because now he is all playing with big ships and naval operations off the coast of Iran. Who knows? Next week he might be focusing on Cuba. So I think from that perspective, there's just not not yet at least a clearly visible institutional structure that could actually sustain the interest, the attention to detail that will be required to make anything from Gaza to any of the other conflicts that they might potentially focus on really sort of the center of their attention, and then spend time, resources, money with some purpose. That I think is probably going to be the greatest challenge. So yes, I mean, it would perhaps even take 5 years before we never hear of the Board of Peace again.
I'm going to ask you both this question. Francesco, I'll ask you first. With all these issues outlined, why would any country pay that $1 billion and join? But what would be the motivation? Yeah.
I don't think that any country has paid that kind of money, although some of those countries are quite rich to afford, like Saudi Arabia. There is no reason. By the way, technically speaking, what can happen is that some member states pays the $1 billion US dollar and then gets kicked out by the chairman, your president, which would be a rather funny situation. So again, I quite honestly think that even the Board of Peace is one demonstration that your president, Donald Trump, is at least exceptionally good to catch the media attention of the entire world for a few days and then go to the next provocation. But it's not a strategy, it's not a plan. Although, again, I understand what Stefan is saying. It is true that the world order is not here any longer, and we need to work to something new.
Stefan, same question. With all these challenges, with all this pessimism, and that I think is well placed, why would any country want to join?
Well, I think there are two reasons potentially why you would want to join. One is that you don't want to get on the president's bad side by refusing him. I mean, when the French president Emmanuel Macron raised some doubts over whether he would join, Trump immediately threatened him with 200% tariffs on French wine. The other reason is that if you are genuinely interested and committed to peace, and you realize that the US is now heading into a direction of unilateralism, you might want to consider that actually being in the room when these discussions happen and when these decisions are being made might be better than to be on the outside and just to complain afterwards. I don't think that this is necessarily going to work. But I would not necessarily accuse every country potentially either accepting the invitation now or potentially paying up $1 billion to do it purely out of selfish or aggrandizing interests.
And with that, I want to thank our panelists. Stefan Wolf, he is a professor of international security at the University of Birmingham. His latest book is Ethnic Conflict: Critical Concepts in Political Science. And his latest article in The Conversation is entitled Donald Trump's Board of Peace Looks Like a Privatized UN with One Shareholder, the US President. And Francesco Grillo, he is professor at Bocconi University and the visiting fellow at the European University Institute. You can find his articles at The Conversation, including Europe Must Reject Trump's Nonsense Accusations of Civilization Erasure, but it urgently needs a strategy of its own, and Donald Trump's Board of Peace, signed at Davos, key points I took away from my visit at the ski resort. Thank you both very much for joining us and for sharing your expertise on this issue.
Thank you very much, Douglas.
Thank you.
When we come back, Donald Trump's Board of Peace has a very specific mission: peace and reconstruction in Gaza. How likely is it to succeed in carrying out this mission? Stay with us.
For Minneapolis, I hear your voice singing through the bloody mist. We'll take our stand for this land and the stranger in our of Minneapolis.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. If the Board of Peace is governing Gaza, shouldn't Palestinians be part of the board? Shouldn't the local community choose its own representatives in a principle of United Nations peacekeeping? Why have Gazans been omitted from the plan? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. So the Board of Peace was initially ostensibly created to govern Gaza as a part of the peace agreement between Israel and Gaza, this Donald Trump's 20-point peace plan, with the intention of removing Israeli military forces in exchange for a neutral transitional government. This was endorsed by the UN Security Council. You can look that up. It's Resolution 2803, and it has very specific tasks outlined. These include creating Palestinian governance, the physical and economic reconstruction of the territory that's really been torn by war, the delivery of public services and humanitarian assistance, and the return of refugees, with a real emphasis on the refugees who fled since October 2023. In this segment, we're going to examine the chances the board is actually able to accomplish these very specific, defined set of goals. Our guests are John Quigley. He's professor of law emeritus at Ohio State University. He's the author of Palestine is a State, A Horse with Black and White Stripes is a Zebra, and The International Diplomacy of Israel's Founders, Deception at the United Nations in the Quest for Palestine. And Omar Tijani, he is the Carol Olson Professor in International Law at the University of the Pacific. He's the author of Negotiating Pluralism, Dilemmas of Decentralization in the Middle East. He wrote that with Asla Bali. And A Two-State Solution That Can Work, A Case for an Israeli-Palestinian Confederation. He wrote that with Limor Yehuda. He was also part of the Palestinian negotiation team at Camp David 2 in 2000 and has worked with the UN on peace-building initiatives with a specific emphasis on legal and judicial reforms in Palestinian governance. Thank you both so very much for joining us. John Quigley, thank you so much for joining us. The first question I have for you is, exactly how daunting is this task for any organization at trying to rebuild Gaza and, you know, trying to accomplish the tasks that the UN has outlined?
It's a monumental task, you know, regardless of who it is that would be undertaking it, and regardless of the personnel and the decision-making structure. The Israelis have brought so much destruction on Gaza that one can't imagine that it could be fixed up in any way to make it livable, short of a substantial number of years. And Mr. Kushner seems to think that it can be done rather quickly. He says these projects are done quickly in other parts of the Arab world, so we can do it rapidly. But I mean, it's hard to imagine, too, how it can be reconstructed in a way that's acceptable to the culture, to the society. Certainly the hotels that Mr. Kushner wants to build are not in that vein. It would be a very different Gaza from the one that has existed so far.
Omar Tijani, the region has been devastated. So even these early stages of what any form of governance in Gaza would need to accomplish, I'd imagine that the primary tasks would be rebuilding the infrastructure, actually, you know, delivering things like, you know, food and water and, you know, and housing, et cetera. The board seems to be focused on things like building hotels. How much confidence should any of us have, and should the Palestinians have, that the board can actually accomplish even those basic tasks that any body that would be rebuilding a war-torn territory would need to do?
It's such an important question. You know, a couple of years ago already, maybe about 18 months ago, there was a really excellent effort by an array of municipalities in the Gaza Strip to put together a plan that would contemplate not only what Gaza might look like in the medium and long term, but also how you would attend to the immediate and incredibly pressing needs of Palestinians of Gaza in the immediate term. It was called the Gaza Phoenix. And it was a really thoughtful plan that was rooted in local experience, that was developed by people who worked in local government and was incredibly professionally done. I mean, when it was shared with me, I thought, wow, I mean, to be on the receiving end of a genocide and in the middle of all of this, to be thinking so coherently about what should be done, how to rebuild these communities in ways that were responsive to their needs and their sense of how their cities should run, that was super impressive to me. And so it's all the more galling, and to your point, concerning that the, you know, so-called Board of Peace plan seems like when you look at the kind of urban design that they have contemplated for Gaza, I mean, it's kind of Reston, Virginia, like plopped onto the eastern parts of the Gaza Strip, combined with, you know, Abu Dhabi along the coast, with very, very little sense of how these spaces would interact with one another and with what Palestinians want to do with their communities, much less respect for things like property rights and for the way people want to run their communities. So I think it's very worrying. And I'll say just a last thing about this, which is that Jared Kushner in his talk at Davos said something like, oh, well, there's very little experience with peace implementation. And so what we've had to do is to, sort of extemporize. And the irony, of course, as Professor Quigley can lay out in far richer detail than I can, is that there is a ton of experience with peace implementation in a range of different contexts. The United Nations doesn't have a perfect record on this front, but it has a very long record. And that experience has yielded lessons about how to go about work of this kind. And at the center of those lessons is engaging with centering the local population. And the fact that you have Benjamin Netanyahu on this board of peace and not a single Palestinian is really not only offensive, but an indication that they're not really paying attention to what Palestinians need and want at the highest level.
I think it's an incredibly important point because, I mean, I'm familiar with the UN and peacekeeping, and all of its most recent statements on reform is the need to engage local communities. That where the UN has done poorly has been a lack of that engagement. Now, John, the resolution at least does suggest there'll be Palestinian representation, though the framing of that is technocratic, apolitical, etc. Do you have any how these Palestinians, how they'd be selected as to be a part of this process, how much of a voice Palestinians might have in that question?
Well, there's no indication that anyone outside the board structure, which essentially means Mr. Trump, would have any say in that selection. So, I mean, they have identified one person, Mr. Ali Shaath, but beyond that, I haven't heard names, and I haven't heard any concept of a mechanism to choose anybody other than by the will of Mr. Kushner or Mr. Trump.
And Omar, there's a historic context to this. I mean, when I hear this, I think throughout negotiations with Palestinians, certainly the Israelis have preferred, the United States has preferred that somebody represent Palestinians, whether it was Jordan traditionally or Egypt or someone else. Is this a repeat in history where once again other Arab states are expected to represent Palestinians? And what does that mean for the Palestinians?
I'm so glad you raised that. I mean, if you look back at UN Security Council Resolution 242, which for many years was the reference point for peace talks, the resolution refers to the Palestinians only obliquely as in relation to the refugee problem, which is meant to be solved. But Palestinians were not at that juncture considered an actor worth consulting, and it would be many years, in fact, decades before Palestinians would be invited to participate in negotiations for deciding their own fate. Well after the Camp David Accords between Israel and Egypt, and only after the first Palestinian Intifada, in which Palestinians said, we will not stand by and let others make these decisions for us. I think the complicated situation that prevails right now is one where the internal division among Palestinians between Hamas and Fatah has, created questions about who the right address should be in these circumstances. And I don't think that that justifies the marginalization from Palestinians from this process. I think that it is really, really important that the process create opportunities for Palestinians to take decisions themselves about how they wish to be represented in these contexts. And I think that we've also, to your point, got to make sure that their role is not just subordinated to the Board of Peace in ways that I think is an echo of what we've seen in the past. But I think there is a difficult process ahead for Palestinians in taking decisions about how they wish to structure internal decision making. Is the PLO going to be re-energized as the forum in which Palestinians take decisions of this kind, and that Palestinians use to represent them on the global stage. Is the Palestinian Authority going to be that actor? Is it going to be a mixture? Are we going to stick to a technocratic group of the kind that the Trump organization seems to favor in the context of the Gaza plans? As John pointed out, the board that is chaired by Ali Schaaf is comprised primarily entirely of technocrats, and there are reasons to commend that. But I think, and this is the last point I'll make, I'm sorry I'm going on, but I think that typically in a transitional process, there will be some attention to saying, okay, the ultimate goal is going to be Palestinian self-determination, in this case, in a Palestinian state, and we are going to begin immediately to chart a course toward that. And to identify the moment at which Palestinians will be able to engage in elections, and even before that, the kinds of institutions that can be involved in. And it's very concerning that that conversation isn't happening at all.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the reconstruction of Gaza, the role the Board of Peace could play, what exactly was the mandate that was given by the United Nations Security Council, and what's been developed in the most recent days. Our guests are John Quigley, he's of Ohio State University, and Omer Dejani, he is of the University of the Pacific. Now, John, the resolution, I actually went to the language of the resolution and laid out the specific tasks. We've been talking about the governance question, because quite frankly, I think it's probably the most important question, who's actually governing. But the physical tasks, physical, rebuilding, delivery of services, and refugees. My question is the return of refugees. There's been a lot of conversation that if you're rebuilding communities, if you're building hotels, you're rebuilding housing, et cetera, where do you house refugees as you're going through that process? Does it seem that the return of refugees is at all a priority? And what does that mean for a Palestinian community that, quite frankly, has a long history of not being allowed to return?
I'm not sure what the plan is, if there is a plan for where to put those people. There is actually a solution that the Board of Peace is not going to consider, but that is required as a matter of law. And that is that the bulk of the population of Gaza is from families that were expelled in 1948. And under international law, they have a right to go back to their home areas. So if the Board of Peace people say, oh, we have no place to put these individuals, you can say, well, do the legal thing, put them back where they are from, and that will reduce the population issue in Gaza. Now, as I say, no one is going to take that seriously because no one in the Board of Peace is going to be worried about the law. I mean, the law, according to the International Court of Justice, is that Israel has to be out of Gaza, full stop. It can't be in this half of Gaza on the eastern side from which it has been encroaching, in fact, over the past few weeks. According to the International Court of Justice, there is no legal basis for the government of Israel to have anything going in Gaza. The government of Israel attacked Gaza in 1967 in an act of aggression, and that means that it has no basis for being there. So, any way you want to talk about the law, Israel should be out, and the Board of Peace plan clearly is starting from the wrong premises.
Could I jump in to talk a little bit about this,
Yeah,
the refugee
please do,
issue as
Omar.
well?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. I agree with John that the broader question of Palestinian refugees' right of return is it remains really important, and I want to come back to that in a moment. In terms of the more narrow framing that I think has been a focus for a while, which is to what extent and at what juncture Palestinians in Gaza who have left Gaza, and the exact numbers are unclear, but it seems like it's, well over 100,000 people who have fled conflict over this last period, to what extent they'll, and at what juncture they'll be allowed to return to the Gaza Strip. And the 20-point plan that the Trump administration released includes a provision that a lot of Palestinians welcomed at the time, that they said augured well for what was to come, because it committed that Palestinians would be allowed to leave the Gaza Strip if they wished during this period of reconstruction, and that anyone who left would be allowed to return, indeed even encouraged to return. And if you look at the scheme that's been set out for building housing in the eastern part of the Gaza Strip, there's the notion that that space, according to the Trump plan, would be dedicated to ensuring that Palestinians who have been displaced, and almost the entire population of the Gaza Strip has been displaced from their homes, that there would be housing for them, albeit within a dystopian regime where you literally have to go through artificial intelligence run checks in order to enter your gated community, all under the watchful eye of Israel and the Board of Peace. So, I mean, there is a lot that's scary about this. But the point I want to make is that there was this commitment to free movement across the Rafah crossing, and even that has yet to be implemented. There's talk about it being implemented in the coming week, and I think that this will be a real litmus test for this process going forward. And then, in terms of the broader question, and this is something that we can talk about perhaps later, but I think, a number of different Palestinian and Israeli thinkers have been thinking about ways looking forward to rethink how these two peoples share this land, recognizing, as John pointed out, that many of the Palestinian residents of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, not to mention Palestinians in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan, are refugees who seek the opportunity to return home. And I think we've got to stop marginalizing their perspectives. And if there's time, maybe at the end we can talk about ideas about how that might be addressed.
Omar, I want to follow up in that we know Palestinians aren't on the board. They don't really have much of a voice other than this technocratic voice, but there are Arab states that do. And with all the statements about how problematic that is to have Arab states representing Palestinians, is there any expectation that Egypt, for example, not wanting to receive all these refugees and also ostensibly would advocate, for them, or Saudi Arabia advocating to ensure that, even this minimal question that we've raised, which is the refugees who fled their homes since 2023, get a chance to return. Do you have any faith that the Arab countries on the board are at least going to demand at a minimum that?
I mean, I honestly think it's a mixed bag. I think that the Arab states are in a relatively weak and disunited position at this juncture. I think that there are actors in each of those governments who genuinely would like to see this process succeed, who see its success as important to their internal legitimacy, and who see peace as being important to the region's stability. And I think the Saudis in particular are very, very concerned that this process not blow up again. For them, their framework of investment for the coming half decade really turns on the maintenance of stability in the area. And so and they've made clear that they won't go forward with normalization with Israel unless they see some shifts. So I don't know to what extent the Saudi Foreign Ministry and the Crown Prince's positions are the same on that front, but the Foreign Ministry has been quite clear. The Emiratis, I think, are a little different. They've got a record across the region that has a lot of people raising eyebrows. And as you point out, the Egyptians and the Jordanians are very, very worried about internal stability within each of their countries, because for Jordan, they understand that if the West Bank is next, and Palestine becomes even more destabilized, that this could be a threat to the monarchy. And the Egyptians, I think, also see the continuing presence of all these Palestinian refugees in Egypt as a force of destabilization. So I think that they would like to see this addressed. I just don't know to what extent they have either the leverage with the Trump administration, particularly Jordan and Egypt. I think Saudi Arabia has more leverage. And I don't know to what extent they are united enough to work strategically to achieve these goals.
That's a good question to raise about how committed are Arab countries. We only have a couple minutes left, and so John, I'll ask you this: that the UN has authorized the Board of Peace to implement this peace plan. That has to be renewed, and also the U.S. has shown, particularly under the Trump administration, has shown a real lack of commitment to the kind of long-term commitment that might be necessary to carry this out. I think we'd all agree that if ever this was going to be stabilized, it's going to take years and years to be able to stabilize. Do you expect that we're all talking about this now, but that the US will probably walk away from this or walk away from that commitment? And if so, is it just opening the door for Israel to once again occupy?
I think President Trump looks for quick fixes to problems. I mean, you can see that he's claimed that he has solved whatever the number is today, international wars, when in fact, when you look at them, that they're not resolved at all. So it's conceivable that if things don't go to his liking within the next 3 months, 6 months, that he will say, well, I tried, and none of the parties are willing to do what they need to do, and we'll walk away, and Israel will resume its occupation of Gaza. I think that is a real possibility. I don't know what to do about it. I think the Security Council really needs to retake the reins here and to come in and say that the Board of Peace, as envisioned by Trump, is well beyond what Resolution 2803 authorized, and that what Mr. Trump is doing is inconsistent with Resolution 2803. Then, when Mr. Trump vetoes that, I think the General Assembly would need to take up the matter as it can under the resolution that was adopted during the Korean War that lets the General Assembly come in and deal with a war and peace situation when the Security Council has been prevented from doing so by virtue of the exercise of veto. Now, that in turn would require a great deal of political organizing on the part of members of the General Assembly. And whether that could happen, I don't know.
Yeah, and that's referred to as a Uniting for Peace resolution, which it hasn't happened since the 50s, but it does sound that's definitely an option. But Omar, we have about 2 minutes left. I want you to have a chance to answer that question too. That if, because it's going to be difficult, and I think we all agree that even if we had confidence in the organization that would be implementing this, it would be incredibly difficult. Do you see the likeliest scenario going to be a declaration that this failed and Israeli occupation then of Gaza?
I wish I had tea leaves. It's hard for me to see how this will succeed. It's hard for me to see the Trump administration admitting failure or ceding ground. I do think that the Israeli government is intent on reoccupying fully the Gaza Strip. The Netanyahu government has made that clear. They just recently said that they plan on maintaining what they refer to as Israeli sovereignty from the river to the sea, including Gaza. And so I think What we've got to wonder is whether the middle powers, as Canadian Premier Mark Carney put it, will step up and acknowledge the ways in which this is a threat to the international system, that this is a reflection of the very problems that he was highlighting, and push back. I think we are at a moment where other states need to step in and say, this whole thing is a sham. That we need to do that, I don't know, means that we will.
Our guests today have been John Quigley. He's a professor of law emeritus at Ohio State University. He's the author of Palestine is a State, A Horse with Black and White Stripes is a Zebra, and The International Diplomacy of Israel's Founders, Deception at the United Nations in the Quest for Palestine. And Omar Dajani, he is the Carol Olson Professor in International Law at the University of the Pacific. He's the author of Negotiating Pluralism, Dilemmas of Decentralization in the Middle East, that's with Asli Bali, and A Two-State Solution That Can Work, The Case for an Israeli-Palestinian Confederation with Limor Yehuda. He also was part of the Palestinian negotiating team at Camp David II in 2000 and has worked with the UN on peace-building initiatives with a specific emphasis on legal and judicial reforms in Palestinian governance. And a quick note, this question about what could be a more sustainable peace, we will certainly return to that question on a future show. Thank you both very much for sharing your time and sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.
Hold the law, but they trample on our rights. If your skin is black or brown, my friend, you can be questioned or deported on sight. In our chains of
ICE out now,
our city's heart and soul persist. Through broken glass and bloody tears on the streets of